Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 78, and the eighth installment of our All Things Boleyn series. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and I'm so glad that you could join us. Now, before we move on to this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful listeners who continue to support this podcast via Podbean Patron, and thank everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. Your support and encouragement is very much appreciated. If you love the podcast and never miss an episode, perhaps you'd consider becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family, and in addition to receiving lots of goodies, you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. June's prize is a choice of two fabulous Tudor-themed mugs from the Colouring Tudor History Collection. Visit colouringtudorhistory.com to view the range, and a big thank you to Catherine Holman for sponsoring this wonderful prize. I'd also like to invite you to join our Talking Tudors Facebook group, where you can chat with other Tudor history lovers and participate in regular Talking Tudors live chats. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Thomas Cromwell and his role in Anne Boleyn's downfall is Professor Diarmaid MacCulloch. Diarmaid MacCulloch is Professor Emeritus of the History of the Church, Oxford University, and Fellow of St. Cross College and of Campion Hall. His History of Christianity, the First 3,000 Years, won the 2010 Cundall Prize. His next book is Sex and the Church, of which his BBC TV series of 2015 was a foretaste. He was knighted in 2012, and his biography of Thomas Cromwell appeared in 2018. My conversation with Professor MacCulloch straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song Elizabeth is from Carlene's best-selling album, inspired by the life of Elizabeth I.
I, sapphire blue, pale skin like the moon, a crown of fire and gold. She will be loved. This I know to be true, my Elizabeth. I, sapphire blue, pale skin like the moon, a crown of fire and gold. She will be loved, this I know to be true, Lady Elizabeth. They'll travel so far to revere and admire, daughter of fire and gold. She will be loved, she will rouse and inspire.
Elizabeth.
welcome to Talking Tudors, Professor McCulloch. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Fantastic. Now, I thought we could begin just by you introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling them a little bit about your background.
Yes, Dermot McCulloch. I'm now Emeritus Professor of the History of the Church at Oxford, which means I've retired. I spent a lot of my career in Oxford, about 20 years, but before that in the University of Bristol, before that in the University of Cambridge. And I was brought up in a country parsonage in East Anglia. So it's a rather classic background, actually, for a Cambridge student. And so I've moved around a bit in universities. And all the time, in the background, there have been the Tudors. My doctoral supervisor at Cambridge was the great Tudor historian, Sir Geoffrey Elton, who could have written a biography of Thomas Cromwell, but didn't, because he felt biography was frivolous and you shouldn't do it unless you had absolutely huge sources. And although the sources for Thomas Cromwell's life were huge, they weren't good enough for Sir Geoffrey.
Okay, now the topic for today's All Things Boleyn conversation is Thomas Cromwell's role in Anne Boleyn's downfall. But before we dive into those slightly murky waters, it would be wonderful if you could just talk to us a little bit about Cromwell's origins and what we know of his early life.
Thomas Cromwell came from a relatively humble background. The humbleness has been exaggerated, particularly by his enemies. But his father was probably an Irishman who had migrated to England sometime around the accession to the throne of King Henry VII and ended up in Putney, where he became a beer brewer, an innkeeper, a miller, and he moved to a nearby place called Wandsworth, on the Thames, between places like Hampton Court and Windsor Castle on the Thames at one end, the City of London at another. So young Thomas Cromwell would have grown up in the 1490s, seeing the great and the good sail past on the River Thames, past his father's pub at some stage, or past his father's mill. And it was clear that this very bright boy wasn't going to stay in the hamlet of Putney. And a bright boy would normally have gone down river to London, but no, this was an exceptional bright boy. So he went through London, over the English Channel, into mainland Europe, and ended up in the great centre of European culture, Italy, and Florence and Venice and the great cities of Italy. He became fluent in speaking Italian, among many other languages. We don't know a great deal about the detail, but that's the general outline, and you can trace the resonances of all those bits of the story I've told you into the rest of his extraordinary career. And worth saying, I think, that if we're talking about early life, that early life went up really until he was nearly 40, by which time a lot of Tudor people were dead.
Yes.
It's extraordinary that, his very brief time in the sun, about 15 years or so, was at that late stage in his life.
Now, before he was, of course, the king's man or Henry's man, he was in the service of Cardinal Thomas Wolsey. So do we know who launched this chapter in his life or his career?
Thomas Wolsey actually came from the same sort of background, not exactly humble, but outside the ranks of the English gentry. And one of his talents was spotting talent. And he clearly spotted a particular talent in Thomas Cromwell. Who put him up to him? Not sure. We know now that Thomas Cromwell had been in the service of Thomas Grey, Marquess of Dorset, for about a year before he entered Wolsey's service. And it may be that Grey said, I've got this really interesting chap. Then Wolsey would have pricked his ears up at one particular thing about this servant of Marquess of Dorset, and that's that he spoke brilliant Italian. Now, the significance of that is this was in 1524, when the cardinal was beginning to plan his tomb, which in those days was a very big deal. Your tomb would be at the centre of a great factory of prayer for your soul to get through purgatory as quickly as possible to heaven. All the great and the good had these chantries, as they were called, chantries, collections of priests, around the tomb. Now, the tomb which Wolsey was planning, had to be the biggest and the best and the most expensive in all Tudor England, if not Europe. And that meant Italian craftsmen. The Italians were the people who made the best tombs. They just made, for instance, the tomb of King Henry VII for his son Henry VIII, and a Florentine sculptor called Torrigiano had done that. Well, Torrigiano was no longer around, but another sculptor from Florence was, and that was the man that Cardinal Wolsey was employing. So the point of this long story about Italians is that the very specific thing that this obscure lawyer called Thomas Cromwell offered Thomas Wolsey was his fluency in Italian. He could do the negotiating with the sculptor, and I don't just mean financial negotiation, I mean getting this huge complex project to the finishing line in the way that the cardinal wanted. He could switch from Italian to speak to the sculptor, a man called Rovizzano, and then go to the cardinal and say, this is how Rovizzano is thinking. What do you think, Your Grace? So that's why he entered the cardinal's service. Talent spotted for that very particular purpose.
And was that his main role? Is that how he served Wolsey for his time with him?
It was all centered around the tomb, but not just negotiating with the Italians, because, as I said, the tomb involved a lot of clergy. You need clergy to pray, and you need them organizing in the proper way. And the way to organize a gaggle of clergy, translate gaggle into Latin, you get collegium. You organize them in a college. So Wolsey set up two colleges, one in his birth town, Ipswich, and the other in Oxford. And the Ipswich College would be a school, and it would produce boys to go to the college in Oxford where they would study, and many of them would become priests, and they'd all be grateful to Wolsey. And in Oxford, there would be a staff at the college who would be doing the praying. We don't actually know where the tomb was planned for. It never happened as a tomb for the cardinal. But the point is that Cromwell was given the task of setting up the colleges, both in Ipswich and Oxford. That's gathering the vast amounts of resources you need to finance these megalomaniac institutions. If the tomb was going to be the best ever, so that the colleges were going to be the best ever, how would you get the money? Even a mega wealthy cleric like Wolsey needed extra resources for this. So what he did as a cardinal legate, that's the Pope's personal representative in England, was to use his powers to dissolve small monasteries. And that's where Thomas Cromwell got his expertise in dissolving monasteries and redeploying their resources for another purpose.
And what was their relationship like? Was it just a working relationship, or was it a little bit closer than that?
No, it was quite clear it's much closer than that. I think in many ways Cromwell saw the cardinal as a model. And curiously, when he became the greatest statesman in the land, you can see various of the cardinal's policies going forward in the name of Cromwell. Well, of course, dissolving monasteries is the obvious one, but lots more things like that than that. Social reform, another big theme. But it's personal, and you can tell that in a very specific way by the coat of arms which Thomas Cromwell adopted in the end and made official. You call it matriculating your arms. And when he matriculated his arms, after the cardinal's death, they referred very specifically to the cardinal's coat of arms. And that wasn't just, you see, a tribute to his master in the master's days of greatness. It was done after the cardinal's death, when the cardinal was in disgrace. So it said something very specific about their relationship. And when Thomas Cromwell entered King Henry VIII's service, it was as the cardinal's man, and that tells you a lot. It explains a lot about his career under the king.
Yes, and as you've mentioned, Cromwell survived Wolsey's downfall and subsequently entered royal service. So can you tell us a little bit more about this period in his life? Who were the main supporters and champions at court for Cromwell?
Well, this is very interesting, and it was, of course, a very delicate period, because here was the servant of a disgraced politician whose many enemies appeared to have triumphed. But as the cardinal faded and Cromwell had to think what to do next, the way he entered the king's service was bizarrely the same as his entry into Wolsey's service. It was to do with that tomb, because there it was, uncompleted, arguably, potentially, the finest tomb in Europe. So what did King Henry VIII do? Well, in his usual ways, he pinched it for his own tomb. It would be, of course, redeployed in terms of what was on it to be a king's tomb, not a cardinal's, but there was lots of stuff you could use from the cardinal's tomb. And who better to go on negotiating with the same sculptor, Benedetto Rovezzano, than Signor Cromwell? And around that, all the things that Cromwell knew about the cardinal's lands, which were now confiscated to the king. Who better than to organize them into the king's possession than Cromwell? And Cromwell actually went on doing his best for the cardinal. And then you ask, who are his main champions and supporters at court? Well, it's pretty obvious who would be his champions and supporters at court. It would be Wolsey's friends. And so it appears. You can see it, actually, from the pages of John Fox's Acts and Monuments, Fox's Book of Martyrs. Fox tells us who his friends were, and one of them, for instance, was Sir John Russell, who later became the first Earl of Bedford. Very much a Wolsey supporter. And therefore, interestingly also, a supporter of Queen Catherine of Aragon against the new lady at court, Anne Boleyn. And that's a consistent pattern with the people you can see as Cromwell's champions when he first entered the king's service. They're pro-Wolsey, they're pro-Catherine, and they're anti-Anne. It's all rather unexpected if you look at the way in which the story has been told traditionally.
Absolutely, yes, definitely. Now, so I find Cromwell's relationship with Chapuis quite interesting, so I wanted to ask you a little bit about this. So he spends a lot of time, obviously, in discussion with Eustace Chapuis, the imperial ambassador. What was their relationship like? And do you think this was a genuine friendship?
It's very complicated. Ambassadors, it might be said, never have real friends. It's not very sensible. But I think they respected each other a lot. Obviously, the problem for Chapuis was that he was the representative of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, who was the nephew of the increasingly wronged queen, Catherine of Aragon. He hated what was being done to Catherine and thought it was vile and utterly unfair. And he could increasingly see that Cromwell had been drawn into the efforts to sideline Catherine and replace her with Anne. So he was furious at that. And when he wrote to his master, the emperor, he emphasized his fury. Well, of course, you would, wouldn't you? But the interesting thing is that alongside that, there is the consistent feeling that, this Cromwell man, he may be doing vile things in the service of his master, but he's not a fool. And as time went on, they would find things in common. And actually, Cromwell was very assiduous when Chapuis had a terrible accident, his house burnt down in London. Cromwell put a lot of energy into finding him somewhere suitable to live. In fact, annoying the elderly Essex knight whose house he basically requisitioned to Chapuis. So the relationship is complex, and you'd expect two men of great capacity to have such a complex relationship.
It is. It's a fascinating and complex relationship. I find that sometimes he appears to be quite, I suppose, candid and unguarded when he's speaking with Chapuis, and Chapuis obviously always rightfully questions his motive. So it's a hard one to assess, I have to say.
It is. But both of them know exactly what they're doing. And Chapuis obviously often commented to his master, the emperor, he was telling me this because he wanted me to hear this point of view. But a lot of the time you feel neither of them are fools, and they are not going to try and spin a line. They're dancing around each other all the time.
All right, let's talk about Cromwell's relationship with Anne then, Anne Boleyn. The traditional tale, of, as you sort of touched on already, is that they were allies until they had some sort of falling out. Usually it's said to be about the funds related to the dissolution of the monasteries, and that this occurred sometime in sort of 1535, 1536, at which point he kind of decides to turn against Anne and her family. Do you believe that the evidence supports this view?
No, I don't. And I had sort of bought the traditional story, particularly when I, 25 years ago, I wrote a biography of Thomas Cranmer. I thought it was obvious that Cromwell and Anne were allies. But the story I've already begun to tell you about the relationship between Cromwell and Wolsey alerted me to the fact that there was a very serious problem with the traditional story. Let's get back to that point. Wolsey is Cromwell's master. Cromwell adores Wolsey and took his arms, his coat of arms, and made it his own with suitable variations after Wolsey's death. As Anne was rising in power and influence and Catherine was going down, this was quite a deliberate thing to do. He must have known that Anne would be furious at these heraldic allusions. You know, people noticed heraldry. This is the language of power. And so Cromwell very deliberately saying, I'm Wolsey's man. He's saying that to Anne, the prospective queen. He's saying that to her uncle, Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk. And that is in 1532-3. Bewilderingly to the casual viewer, at the same time, he's increasingly involved in the efforts to get the king his annulment of his first marriage to Catherine, and he is very active in getting Anne on the throne to the extent of organising her coronation in 1533. So you'd think, yes, of course they're allies. But then you start actually thinking about this set of relationships, and you look at the years in which Anne was queen, and you look at Cromwell's career, and you look at responsibilities which he was being given, and they were not very publicly stated. He was, for the most part, in very minor offices of the crown, and yet, by 1535 or so, he was clearly the chief minister. Now, why that curious out-of-syncness between the public titles and the real power? I think it's because Henry VIII wanted to give him as much power as possible, and Anne didn't. And Henry was a real coward. He did not like stand-up rows, and Anne was very good at stand-up rows. So I think Henry quietly gave Cromwell power. I think the most telling silence or absence is the fact that even when Thomas Cromwell had organised the coronation of Anne Boleyn, he did not get a knighthood.
Yeah.
He was not made a knight, but more bizarre than that, he was the man responsible for collecting fines from people who did not want to be knighted at her coronation, because it would involve a lot of expense for them. He's doing the admin for that. He's organising the knighthoods and non-knighthoods, and yet he's not knighted. What happens after Anne's death? He got his knighthood, but he got more than that. He got his peerage. He was made Lord Privy Seal. All these things sort of rushing out once the Queen had gone. And that suggests to me she was holding his career back. And so it's not a sudden falling out in 35, 36. It's the building up of tensions which were structurally part of their relationship.
There is a letter that Chapuis writes in 1535 where he mentions that Cromwell's told him that he's had a falling out with the Queen, and that she's basically said, you know, she'll have his head off type thing. And he said he trusts so much in his master that he's not too concerned. But of course, Chapuis is questioning that. He's kind of puzzled, thinking, what's he want from me?
Yeah. Well, I think for once, Cromwell was saying it just as it was. And Chapuis naturally thought would look at the political situation and think, well, of course they're allies. He's doing the disgraceful things I hate. He's promoting the Boleyn marriage. I think we've got to read that in terms of Cromwell's loyalty to the king, not his love for Anne Boleyn.
Now, Anne, obviously, she's executed on the 19th of May, 1536. And a couple of weeks later, Chapuis writes again to Charles V, and he is talking about a meeting that he had with Cromwell, again, another meeting. And he states that Cromwell, and this is the kind of translated quote that's most often used, had planned and brought about the whole affair. But before he mentions this, and we don't hear this too often in many of the biographies, he actually says that Cromwell says he'd been authorised and commissioned by the king to prosecute and bring to an end the mistress's trial. So do you think there's any reason for us to doubt the truthfulness of Chapuis' account?
No, I don't. He'd been watching the situation very carefully. He was now seeing the unravelling of truth. And the point is that it actually corresponds to a literary source which has been very much overlooked until recent years. And that's the account of a strange Scotsman called Alexander Alesius, or at least he called himself Alexander Alesius. His real Scots name was Alan. It's a sort of pretension, academic pretension, calling himself Alesius. The point is, Alesius, many years later, wrote a long, long letter to Elizabeth I when she came to the throne, Anne Boleyn's daughter, to tell her about what had happened in the run-up to her mother's execution. And Alesius's story is that it all went back to a tip-off from France that Anne had been indulging in adultery with courtiers. And this story came back to England, and it was Thomas Cromwell who took it forward. Now, that does correspond with this conversation with Chapuis, but it also corresponds to yet another piece of neglected evidence from a former servant of Catherine of Aragon, 1537-8. And this servant, looking back to the events of 1536, and saying that Thomas Cromwell, in January 1536, or probably just after Anne Boleyn's miscarriage in winter, Thomas Cromwell had been in touch with the Lady Mary, that's Catherine of Aragon's daughter, Princess Mary, and they were already, therefore, in touch in winter 1536. What were they in touch about? Putting her back in the succession to the throne, which would, of course, imperil the whole Boleyn project. It would imperil Anne. So all these things, fit them together, and you've got a very consistent picture of Cromwell deciding in winter 1536 to use this rumour about Anne, which probably not true, but a rumour which infuriated the king, and played on the king's already tense feelings about Anne, and used these feelings towards whatever would inconvenience Anne and probably in the end destroy her. I think the plan would only have built up as circumstances made it clear how it would go. And at the centre of that would be the king's emotions. Henry VIII was a man who could love you or hate you, and there would be nothing much in the middle. So he loved Anne, absolutely, passionately loved her, but then found her much more intimidating as a wife than a mistress. And with that sort of passion, it would turn to hatred. Cromwell would notice, Cromwell could use that, Cromwell could work with that, Cromwell could run with that. And that's the point of the king commissioning Cromwell. Anne would not have been destroyed if the king had not wanted it. But Thomas Cromwell was there to use the king's emotions for a purpose which would thoroughly suit him, getting rid of Anne.
Do you think Henry believed that Anne was guilty of those charges, or do you think that was all sort of part of that plan that Cromwell came up with?
I think he made himself believe them.
Yes. And
he is one of those monstrous narcissistic egos that everything revolves around him, and the truth is something which is that which suits Henry. So I think he genuinely believed the dreadful old nonsense which was thrown at Anne, because it suited him and it suited what he wanted to do next, which was marry someone else. the cynical way in which he did that, it's not even cynicism, it's just utter selfish narcissism. And it does Cromwell no favours to say that he went along with it, but that seems to me the most plausible reading of events.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. For anyone listening, I do again recommend your biography for more details, and they can delve into that a little bit more. But I did want to ask you also, often a lot is made about the fact that Cromwell was away from court for a couple of weeks right before Anne's arrest. But he was often away from court. He was often sick. So what was it exactly that he had? Do we know?
No, we don't. He did have these frequent bouts of ill health, but at the time, you know, London is a very unhealthy place, and it's not just plague, it's malaria.
Right. Yeah.
And it could be that these are bouts of malaria, and they did certainly come at an extraordinarily inconvenient time, and no doubt also exacerbated by stress. And that spring was really very stressful, and you can see exactly why he genuinely would be ill at crucial times.
Absolutely. I don't know how he managed to do everything that he did. Just his remembrances are quite overwhelming, his little to-do lists that he keeps, and you just think, how on earth did this man do the job of 10 people or something? It's incredible.
But I mean, what really sold me on the fact that he's throwing everything into the destruction of Anne is at the very weekend of Anne's arrest, Cromwell gave back to the king a wonderful house on the fringes of North London, which the king had given him only a few months before. It had been the house of the Earl of Northumberland. The king had taken it. Cromwell had been given it and spent a huge sum of money on it in winter, spring 1536. And then in spring 1536, at the height of the crisis which led to Anne's arrest, he gave it back to the king. Now, you don't do that for a house you've spent a lot of money on without very good reason. And I think it's a sweetener to actually consolidate what's going to happen to Anne.
Now, Professor McCulloch, I'd like to finish with a question from one of our listeners. So Carrie would like to know what you think Cromwell would make of his portrayal in Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall series, very popular series.
Yeah, I think he'd have liked it very much.
Yes, I think so.
I'm a huge admirer of it. I think it's an extraordinarily perceptive picture of power. It is not history, and we have to keep saying that, and Hilary would say that. It is a novel, but it's a novel underpinned by a profound understanding of the period. And her Cromwell is rather like my Cromwell. I read the first two volumes after I'd done a lot of research on the period, and I picked up the same Cromwell. I thought, wow, yes, you've got it, lady. And in particular, the antagonism between Cromwell and Anne, she picked that up. I actually wrote her a fan letter.
Having read the first
one. I said, look, you know this is a great novel. It's just won the Booker Prize. But I want to tell you that this is the Tudor England I recognise. And I gasped at the detail you knew. So I think he'd have been pleased. He might have said, oh, I think I was a bit more religious than that. And Hilary, I think, would admit that she hasn't played up the religion as much as she could. But otherwise, that sense of being an observer, that's a very interesting facet of his thousands of surviving papers, because they're virtually all the incoming correspondence, what you might call the inbox in email terms. You don't hear his voice much. And in that sense, you feel, as you read the actual archive, that you're observing like he was. Now, I would spend days going through the archive in the British Library and the National Archive, often at my own laptop, as I am at the moment, because it is now online, the original document. But at the end of the day, I just felt exhausted. And then one of those days, about half past six in the evening, I thought, actually, I'm feeling just like Cromwell would have done. I read all these letters about coming in at him. And yes, observer, that trick that Hilary has of making him he throughout. He's even observing himself, let alone everything else in Tudor England. So Yeah, that's got him right. That's got him right.
Now, I need to end by asking you for a Berlin takeaway. So we always end with this question on the Talking Tudors podcast. And this is just a little gem for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode. And it might help them, you know, deepen their love of the period. It could be a film, a song, a website. Do you have a Berlin takeaway for us?
Yes, it's not exactly on period, but it's a great piece of choral music from a man who certainly was alive, very much alive in the 1530s, Thomas Tallis. In the reign of Anne's daughter Elizabeth, he wrote an extraordinary piece of choral music in 40 parts. That's 8 choirs of 5, all singing different parts, all 40 different parts. It's called Spem in Allium. I have no other hope but thee, O Lord. And it just suggests the magnificence of the Tudor court. It may have been written for Lord Lumley, who was living at Nonsuch Palace, that great creation of Henry VIII. And as you listen to it, you get that sense of just the sheer extravagance of everything at the Tudor court, in religion, in politics, in decoration, and it's also magnificent music. It's not just a freak. It is one of the great masterworks of 16th century music. So I recommend people to go away and listen to it. You probably need to listen to it twice. I once sung it twice in a concert. We sang it once at the beginning of the concert, once at the end, because it's too good not to repeat.
Well, that sounds wonderful. I'm going to go and listen to it straight after this. So thank you very much. Now, before I let you go, sorry, I did say that was the last thing. What's next for you? Are you working on any new books at the moment?
Yes, I am. And I'm always very restless and jump around. So I'm getting something very different. Having done my detailed Tudor research, I'm going to a vast subject, which is sex and the church, a history. Right. So 2,000 years of what the church has said, both good and bad, mostly bad, frankly, on the subject of sex, the family, gender, etc. So that's my project for the next 4 years.
Wow, fantastic. Well, best of luck with that project. And thank you so much for agreeing to chat with us and joining us on this All Things Berlin series. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.